face of all the hardships and sanctions and choose their uprising over giving up. Between resistance and surrender, they choose the former.
It was the Islamic faith that drove our youngsters during the eight-year war. If there were another war to break out now, what do you think would drive them?
As a historian who has authored The Biology of Many Martyrs and has been at the war front, I would say that those who were today fighting Daesh have done much more sacrifice than what we did. Those who are fighting Daesh in Syria have much stronger faith than our generation. We really envy them and we feel that we are distant from them.
Another example is resistance against Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And in case you're wondering how it all started, revolutionary Shiism emerged in the 1960s in response to global anti-colonial movements. It centered on resistance against oppression with a look to Shia fighters and martyrdom and by drawing on the Karbala metaphor. To Iran as a state, the tale is more than a script for passion plays or even history books. The post-revolution constitution commands support for the oppressed and Muslims of the world, and it's claimed to have been inspired by the ordeal of Imam Hussein and companions. How bravely Imam Hussein might have fought would not matter if his only intention were to score a battlefield win, because he was surrounded by an army attacking on all sides with spears, swords and arrows, and eventually Shim ruthlessly beheaded him, thirsty and heavily wounded. But not to fear, because words carry far and long, and that's all a legacy needs, to be related and learned from. And this is where Zainab, peace be upon her, comes in.
After Imam Hussein and his companions are martyred in the scene of Ashura, their enemies take Hazrat Zainab as a captive and chain her, taking the captives from city to city in the worst possible way until they reach the Levant. They cheer to humiliate the family of Imam Hussein, but the exact opposite of what they wanted happened, because Hazrat Zainab was an orator so skillful that people said it was as if Imam Ali was speaking when he delivered a speech. While giving a speech in Yazid's court, she commanded everyone to silence, and all the participants in the majestic court of Yazid immediately became silent to listen to her sermons. Her speech made Yazid's family, who was sitting behind a veil, cry and oppose him. Her sermons were so powerful that his rule didn't last long after.
The merging of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance movement with the ideals of the Ashura uprising can be seen in Chapter 10 on Foreign Policy, Article 152. That bases the country's foreign policy on the rejection of any kind of domination, the preservation of all-inclusive independence of the country, the defense of the rights of all Muslims, and non-alignment in relation to domineering powers.
Iran's Islamic Revolution was a phenomenon that was 15 years in the making from the year 1964 and gradually became complete. During the course of time, the leadership found its meaning and the Imam found its true place. That was made possible by Muslims with lofty aspirations and motives.
The Islamic Revolution started from religious morning gatherings. These gatherings have been special as they recount the truths about Ashura and underline the importance of fighting against evil, although with a few fighters. This is significant as people are shown how to follow the truth in the way Imam Hussein and his companions did.
We said the Islamic resistance had been successful. Since 1979, revolutionary Shiism has linked Tehran with a network of Shia groups in the region. These include Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq, and the Houthis in Yemen. And it's not just a matter of fighting power, but winning the hearts and minds of regional brethren.
Basically, any uprising that arises to fight against oppression becomes permanent and truth-seeking, and righteous people will follow it. The uprising of Ashura is a complete tragedy due to its unique historical characteristics. It's an event in which women and children were involved from its creation until it ended in conveying the message of resistance and perseverance.
That would be the end of our account of the day. Thanks from the whole team. But we've an account a week, so do join us again at the same times next week and each week after. Till then, bye.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Using the same deceitful tactics they pioneered in Vietnam, U.S. political and military officials repeatedly misled the country about the prospects of success in Afghanistan. Numerous documents, largely ignored by the public, proved that U.S. officials knew what they were saying was false. Just as happened so many times in prior wars, and even deliberately doctored information to enable their lies, says Glenn Greenwald, writer, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Government Lied for Two Decades About Afghanistan. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The Taliban regime is coming to an end, announced President George W. Bush at the National Museum of Women in the Arts on December 12, 2001. Almost 20 years ago today, 5 months later, Bush vowed, in the United States of America, the terrorists have chosen a foe unlike they have faced before. We will stay until the mission is done. 4 years ago after that, in August of 2006, Bush announced, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban lost a coveted base in Afghanistan and they know they will never reclaim it when democracy succeeds. The days of the Taliban are over. The future of Afghanistan belongs to the people of Afghanistan. For 2 decades, the message Americans heard from their political and military leaders about the country's longest war was the same. America is winning. The Taliban is on the verge of permanent obliteration. The U.S. is fortifying the Afghan security forces, which are close to being able to stand on their own and defend the government and the country. Just weeks ago, on July 8, President Biden stood in the East Room of the White House and insisted that a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan was not inevitable because, while their willingness to do so might be in doubt, the Afghan government and leadership clearly have the capacity to sustain the government in place. Biden then vehemently denied the accuracy of a reporter's assertion that your own intelligence community has assessed that the Afghan government will likely collapse. Biden snapped, this is not true. They did not reach that conclusion. Biden continued his assurances by insisting that the likelihood there is going to be one unified government in Afghanistan controlling the whole country is highly unlikely. He went further, the likelihood that there is going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely. And then is an exchange that will likely assume historic importance in terms of its sheer falsity. From a presidential podium, Biden issued a decree. When asked about the Taliban being stronger than ever after 20 years of U.S. warfare there, Biden claimed, relative to the training and capacity of the Afghan National Security Forces and the training of the federal police, they're not even close in terms of their capacity. On July 21st, General Mark Milley, Biden's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, conceded that there is a possibility of a complete Taliban takeover or the possibility of any number of other scenarios, yet insisted the Afghan security forces have the capacity to sufficiently fight and defend their country. Similar assurances have been given by the U.S. government and military leadership to the American people since the start of the so-called War on Terror. Are we losing this war? Army Major General Jeffrey Schulzer, commander of the 101st Airborne Division, asked rhetorically a news briefing from Afghanistan in 2008, answering it this way. Absolutely no way. Can the enemy win it? Absolutely no way. On September 4, 2013, then-Lieutenant General Milley, now Biden's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, complained that the media was not giving enough credit to the progress they had made in building up the Afghan National Security Forces. This army and this police force have been very, very effective in combat against insurgents every single day, General Milley insisted. None of this was true. It was always a lie, designed first to justify the U.S. endless occupation of that country, and then, once the U.S. was poised to withdraw, and to concoct a pleasing fairy tale about why the prior 20 years were not, at best, an utter waste. That these claims were false cannot be reasonably disputed as the world watches the Taliban takeover of all of Afghanistan as if the vaunted Afghan National Security Forces were the dolls using paper weapons. But how do we know that these statements made over the course of two decades were actual lies rather than just the widely wrong claims delivered with sincerity? To begin with, we have seen these tactics from U.S. officials lying to the American public about wars to justify both their initiation and continuation over and over. The Vietnam War, like the Iraq War, was begun with a complete fabrication disseminated by the intelligence community and endorsed by corporate media outlets that the North Vietnamese had launched an unprovoked attack on U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. In 2011, President Obama, who ultimately ignored a congressional vote against authorization of his involvement in the war in Libya to topple Muammar Gaddafi, justified the NATO war by denying that regime change was the goal. Our military mission is narrowly focused on saving lives. Broadening our military mission to include regime change would be a mistake. Even as Obama issued those false assurances, the New York Times reported that the American military has been carrying out an expansive and increasingly potent air campaign to compel the Libyan army to turn against Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. They did for the war in Afghanistan. U.S. political and military leaders lied for years to the American public about the prospects for winning in Vietnam. On June 13, 1971, the New York Times published reports about thousands of pages of top secret documents from military planners that came to be known as the Pentagon Papers, provided by former RAND official Daniel Ellsberg, who said he could not, in good conscience, allowed the official lies about the Vietnam War to continue. Documents revealed that U.S. officials in secret were far more pessimistic about the prospects for defeating the North Vietnamese than their boastful public statements suggested. In 2021, the New York Times recalled some of the lies that were demonstrated by that archive on the 50th anniversary of its publication. There was virtually nothing that could happen in Afghanistan without U.S. intelligence community's knowledge. There is simply no way that they got everything so completely wrong while innocently and sincerely trying to tell American the truth about what was happening there. In sum, U.S. political and military leaders have been lying to the American public for two decades about the prospects for success in Afghanistan generally and the strength and capacity of Afghan security forces in particular. Up through 5 weeks ago, when Biden angrily dismissed the notion that U.S. withdrawal would result in a quick and complete Taliban takeover. Numerous documents largely ignored by the public proved that U.S. officials knew what they were saying was false, just as happened so many times in prior wars, and even deliberately doctored information to enable their lies. Any residual doubts about the falsity of those two decades of optimistic claims has been obliterated by the easy, enlightening, fast blitzkrieg whereby the Taliban took back control of Afghanistan as if the vaunted Afghan military did not even exist, as if it were August 21 all over again. It is vital not just to take note of how easily and frequently U.S. leaders lie to the public about its wars once those lies are revealed at the end of those wars, but also to remember this vital lesson the next time U.S. leaders propose a new war using the same tactics of manipulation, lies, and deceit. The spotlight.
The term vaccine inequality has been used for developing countries who have not received appropriate jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. That has been one of the topics covered by Iran's leader in his most recent statements, in which he also slammed some foreign countries for failing to abide by their promises in providing vaccines, for example, to Iranians. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why vaccine distribution is not reaching many poor or developing countries, and why vaccine inequality is persisting.
All the figures point to one fact. COVID-19 vaccine distribution is not fair. To date, over 4.5 billion jabs have been administered worldwide, according to data from the University of Oxford. Wealthy countries have consumed the lion's share of vaccines, with more than 4 out of 5 doses given to people living in high and upper middle income countries. Low income nations have administered less than 0.5% of shots. To further illustrate the wide divide, we can look at the statistics of the United States. The country has administered over 350 million doses. That translates to 106 doses per 100 American. In Africa, that number is around 6 per 100 people. To make matters worse, as some countries have not been able to even kick off their vaccination campaigns, rich nations are considering giving additional jabs to people already fully inoculated. Germany, France, Russia, and the UAE have already started offering booster shots, while the US and the UK have announced or hinted at plans to do so in the near future. This has caused much outrage among activists. Most recently, a group of campaigners slammed Britain for ordering millions of booster jabs, saying the UK is effectively pushing poor countries to the back of the vaccine queue. The World Health Organization has called for a halt on boosters through at least by the end of September. The UN health body urged rich nations to give shots to the poorer countries that are struggling to inoculate even their highly vulnerable populations. But the US almost immediately rejected the plea, saying it has already donated more doses than any other country. That does not seem to have convinced the WHO. On Tuesday, the organization again slammed the existing divides in COVID-19 vaccine distributions as disgraceful and called for a more equitable approach. It said the power to overturn the imbalance lies in the hands of only 20 leaders around the world. The World Health Organization says it wants every country to have vaccinated at least 10% of its population by the end of September. But with the current pace of vaccination drive in the world's underprivileged nations, that goal might be too hard to achieve.
Joining up for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Fia Garajan Sundararaman. He's a global project coordinator for People's Health Movement's Equitable Access to Essential Health Technologies in the context of COVID-19. Also joining us, Gloria Taliani, infectious disease specialist, who joins us from Rome. Okay, let me first start with you, Fia Garajan, if I may. The title that I read over here sounds like something that may need a little bit of explanation in the context of our program, because it sounds like, obviously, when we notice the word equitable access in the context of COVID-19, that is applicable to what we're covering today.
So this has been one of the big concerns from the beginning. By the way, you can call me Sundar, just S-U-N-D-A-R.
Okay.
What we are finding, as the statement pointed out, is that the high-income countries, you are having more than 104 doses to 105 doses per 100 people, whereas in Africa, you are having much less, about 6. If you look at the second dose, how many people have given the second dose, what proportion of the population has been covered, it's minuscule in most of the developing world. And even in the highest, which would be the Latin American countries like Argentina, Brazil, Cuba, and Costa Rica, would be in the 15% to 19% range, as compared to, say, 62% or 69% for Canada and the UK and France, etc. And if you look at countries like Nigeria, they haven't even reached 1% of full vaccination coverage. Now, that's really shameful, because when this started out, the world leaders promised the vaccines as a global public good. It's far from that today. In fact, it has become one of the most profitable commodities in the market today. And in some senses, the overall policy design seems still more geared towards profit making than actually reaching out to the health emergency that is ongoing. And that's because largely of the way the multinational corporations dominate the production and supply chains that produce this vaccine, and the way that governments allow them to do.
Uh-huh. Well, Gloria Taliani, let me just quote what the World Health Organization has said. First of all, it's pressing the 20 most powerful world leaders and pharmaceutical chiefs to reverse this disgraceful inequity, as they call it, or inequality that exists in the global access to COVID-19. And it's looking at the 19 countries to avert yet another deadly wave of cases that's happening. And I'm going to use the quote by the WHO chief, which is composed of a statistic. It says, he said, only 1.1%. 1.1% of people in low-income countries have received at least one dose due to lack of supplies. Only 1.1% of people in low-income countries. I mean, that's really hard to imagine. Can you please elaborate on that for us?
Well, we have many problems at the same time. The first problem is the inequality, which you quoted. And this is really difficult to accept in an apparently interchanging world. And in spite of the declarations that were performed and done by COVAX projects that intended to give all citizens of the world the same opportunity to as during the full vaccine course. So this is the first problem. The second problem is that in countries where the number of vaccine administration doses have been intermediate and the circulation of the virus is wide, we have a condition which is extremely dangerous because the pressure of the vaccine is intermediate, let's say, such in India, for instance, where in spite of 500 million doses administered up to date, there is a coverage of doses per 100% people of only 36.7%. It means that the virus circulates in the presence of a low intermediate number of vaccinated people, and the pressure of the selection of new mutants may be dangerous, as it has been demonstrated by the occurrence of the Delta variant. The third problem is that, in spite of all the declaration that WHO has done, the COVAX enterprise has done, and so on, if we don't allow low-income countries to make their own vaccine by allowing them to produce it and abolishing the intellectual property, at least for this condition, which is a condition in which if the cure is not given to all, or anyway the protection is not given to all the population in the world, we will never succeed in fighting the spread. So the three problems should be examined in a kind of net thinking performed by finding the best solution of the problem.
I see. Well, Mr. Sundar, obviously there's so many questions that need to be asked here, and I'm trying to ask the most important ones before we run out of time. And one of the things that startlingly stands out is what was pledged just very recently, the G7 meeting, where you had the world leaders that promised 1 billion COVID vaccine doses for poorer nations. I don't know if you remember, where the Prime Minister of the UK said that he rejected what he called nationalistic approaches. He said, already of the 1.5 billion vaccines that have been distributed around the world, I think that people in this country should be very proud that 500 million of them are a result of the actions taken by the UK government. You had the U.S. Prime Minister, I'm sorry, the U.S. President Joe Biden that came out pledging some 500 million doses altogether, again, 1 to 1.5 billion doses roughly. Did they fall short, and why did they?
The point is that much of the actions of the developed nations can be understood only in terms of diplomatic action to prevent any weakening of the intellectual property regime. South Africa and India have filed before the World Trade Organization for a complete waiver of the IPR so that you could actually manufacture and transfer technology effectively to the developing world. This has been blocked. And though on paper the U.S. has not approved, has not opposed it, in fact has accepted that it should go on to further negotiations, the European Union has steadily blocked any particular discussion on this issue. So we do need to actually multiply the total number of manufacturers and the total size of manufacturers and the total volume manufactured all much, much more than what is there today. Today what we have is effectively a monopoly by a few companies. Most of them are based in the West. There's only a few exceptions with them in the developing world, and they are also captive within their countries, not able to anyway even provide their commitment to the COVAX. The COVAX itself has been a great disappointment. It was a facility set up internationally to do exactly what you were saying, to provide this 1 billion vaccines that the developing world needed, and a promise to give at least 20% of the vaccines requirement of the least developed countries free. It's not done that. It has failed to raise the money. It has failed to sign agreements with the companies to the required degree. It has failed to dispatch the vaccine. So at some point, all that it has succeeded is to prevent a more vigorous, united, coordinated effort of the developing world to break the bottlenecks and barriers and start their own manufacture on that. So much of the policies is only meant to distract from or break all the barriers against the transfer of technology and intellectual property to the developing world. And that's really a shame, because in the midst of a pandemic, that has affected even the developed countries in a major way. They don't seem to have learned their lesson.
Okay. The intellectual property right, or the patent, Gloria Taliani, obviously needs to be released to countries in order for them to produce it, such as India. But the U.S. has come out and said, you know, we're thinking about that. Joe Biden, this is months ago, and then came out and said, we're probably going to end up giving the patents. But that has not happened yet. It sounds like it's all about money, because the pharmaceuticals are saying, obviously have a say in it, I'm sure. Why is it that the U.S. or countries like the U.S., we could talk about also U.K. perhaps, are not forcing these pharmaceuticals to give out the patent? Is it because of the fact that it's merely about profits?
Probably this is the core of the problem, but it's difficult to imagine new strategies in a new condition such as the pandemic, which is totally unusual for our way of thinking. What is really difficult to understand is that those people do not realize indeed that probably pharmaceutical company will lose some money if they allow other companies to make the vaccine by giving the possibility of performing and producing themselves their vaccine. But if they renounce to the intellectual property, probably they will save, all of us will save much more money in terms of human deaths and expenditures for sanity assistance and economical disruption. And this is something we should really measure against economical advantage of the
pharmaceutical. So why aren't they doing that? I'm sorry to jump in here. Why aren't they doing that? And I'd like to continue with your train of thought. I'm going to throw in this particular statistic so then you can continue with what you were saying, where the world economy might suffer $9.2 trillion price tag for failing to vaccinate the world.
Because of an equilibrium of power, let's say, pressure of pharmaceutical companies probably as more power than any other political and economical pressure over the politics that have the decision in their hands. This is the only explanation, reasonable explanation, because if we count the advantages and the disadvantages of interrupting the intellectual property, it's obvious, it's even trivial to understand that in this condition, allowing other countries to make their own vaccines would be much more convenient.
Well, let's see here, Mr. Sundar. One of the things that is very bothersome, this was a piece of statistic that came out just a couple months ago, and it's about vaccine hoarding. And the particular country that was mentioned here is the United States, fully vaccinated more than a quarter of its population back then, secured 1.2 billion doses, which meant every person in the U.S. received two doses, and double dosing is only required for two of the three currently approved vaccines. And then it says that it could vaccinate its entire population of 330 million and still have more than half a billion surplus vaccines. Can't there be oversight so the hoarding doesn't take place?
There should be, but there is not. And at some point, it is not easy task to do because they have manufactured it and they keep it. Remember, when you are sort of indicating that the company should give the patent or should give the vaccine to the developing world, that's not how it works. What we have is actually allowing companies in the South to make the vaccine, irrespective of whether these people are giving it or not. The companies in the South are capable of manufacturing. It may not be a new product, but they are capable of manufacturing these vaccines on their own with or without major help. They should just be allowed to do so. It's not a question of, when you're saying giving, you're implying what the process of voluntary licensing. That's good, but not good enough. And anyway, you can see that they have not voluntarily licensed enough manufacturers. So we must actually move to people declaring that, never mind, forget it, you keep your vaccines, you keep your patents, we will manufacture those things because we have a right to do so. The U.S. did it for ciprofloxacin when they had the anthrax outbreak. So the U.S. applies compulsory licensing at will. And why should not a developing country faced with a much larger threat than the anthrax ever was do so? For the HIV drugs, this was done again. So the whole point is there are enough worldwide precedences for applying compulsory licensing. But compulsory licensing today legally is a huge problem. And that is why we are saying to simplify matters, just remove just one resolution in the WTO saying that these IPR TRIPS conditionalities won't apply. Just one line statement will be able to make a huge change in vaccine availability across the world.
Okay.
I'm optimistic about the challenges of domestic manufacture, but eventually this can be done.
Yes, hopefully that'll get done. And that brings me to my final question here, Gloria Taliani. I'm not too sure what type of appeal can be made from this program out to you and to the world. Because on an emotional basis, when you take a look at the suffering that the world is going through, we are one of the countries that have been hardest hit in this region. You're looking at other countries in the world severely suffering from these deaths. There's no room for any, everything's at maximum point, it appears. So from an emotional perspective, there needs to be some kind of appeal made to the world leaders where there's some kind of mobilization, perhaps. You obviously can expand more on that, where authorities in charge realize the depth of the problem, which I'm sure they do, but to act on it to stop the deaths that are happening. So what would you suggest to move forward from here on?
I think that the most relevant issue is that this is a pandemic. And apparently it doesn't seem to be stopping itself as we wanted, as we expected, as we hoped. So we have to do something really effective to stop it. And starting from organization and starting also for considering that if we don't solve the problem in a global fashion, we will never solve it in short time. For instance, it would be very useful to use to employ the vaccines that have only one shot to cover, they can cover the vaccine with only one shot. In some countries, in some conditions, it would be of relevant importance to do that in spite of having the distribution of the Janssen vaccine only to 38 countries compared to the distribution of AstraZeneca to 176 or Pfizer-BioNTech to 107. And this is difficult to understand.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're just fresh out of time. I got to jump in. Thank you very much for your contributions, both Gloria Taliani, infectious disease specialist, and Thea Gairajan, Sundarar Rahman, Global Project Coordinator, People's Health Movement's Equitable Access to Essential Health Technologies in the Context of COVID-19. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikava Tafwe, entire team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. U.S. right-wing politicians leave parents of vulnerable children with an impossible dilemma. Send children to school where others are unmasked or keep them home again. We now present you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled Children Caught in COVID Culture Wars as U.S. Politicians Defy Health Advice. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Robin McCarthy was eagerly preparing for the return of her six-year-old son to in-person classes at his Miami public school at the start of the new school year. After 18 months of grueling lockdown at home, learning through Zoom, it was finally time for the boy to re-enter the world outside. Robin McCarthy said, "We were excited and we were ready," adding, "We bought the uniforms, we had the masks all ready to go, we felt confident that the school would do a great job in keeping our son and everybody else safe." Then a four-page document titled Executive Order 21175 was issued by the Republican Governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. It began by espousing scientifically dubious claims that there was no proof that wearing face masks in schools protected kids against COVID-19, that the face coverings could inhibit breathing, that children do not play a significant role in spreading the virus, and that even if they did get infected, they were at low risk of becoming seriously ill. The order stipulated the decision on whether children wear face masks in classrooms should be left to the parents. School boards across Florida would henceforth be banned from imposing mask mandates, and that refused to comply would face penalties, including forfeiting of state funds. Describing her reaction to the executive order, Robin McCarthy said, "My mouth dropped to the ground," adding, "It came out of left field, and now we have no idea what we're going to do." McCarthy's son was diagnosed with asthma at the start of the pandemic. The family had been exceptionally careful to maintain social distancing and mask wearing for the fear that he would be infected with COVID. The consequences for him, given his underlying condition, could be dire or even fatal. The governor's executive order cut across the caution like a slap in the face. By permitting and encouraging children not to wear face masks in schools, Ron DeSantis had effectively ended the boy's hopes of returning to in-person education. Robin McCarthy said, "This is an egregious misuse of power." The governor says he's helping parents, but he has stripped us of our choice. One or two kids without face masks in the classroom could risk my son getting really sick. Robin McCarthy is one of thousands of parents in Florida left in limbo by Governor Ron DeSantis' politically charged move to prevent school districts from protecting their pupils and staff through mask mandates. The order presents these families with a dilemma. Send your kids into a potentially dangerous school environment in which the highly contagious new Delta variant of COVID might be running amok, or keep them at home with all the hardships that involves. Florida's ban on mask mandates in schools has fallen at precisely the moment in the trajectory of U.S. pandemic when COVID protections for children are needed most. Data is patchy, but it all points in the same direction. Across the nation, the disease has begun by disproportionately affecting communities of color, is now inflicting its wrath on the most vulnerable groups of all, children. The American Academy of Pediatrics reported that nationwide 94,000 children tested positive for COVID in the week ending 5th of August, a substantial increase since the beginning of July. The Delta variant of the coronavirus is so highly transmissible that it is marching its way through unvaccinated populations, and there is no population in the United States today as unvaccinated as kids. The COVID vaccine is as yet unavailable for 50 million Americans under the age of 12. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, fewer than a third of 12 to 15-year-olds have been fully vaccinated, a substantially lower proportion than any other eligible age group. The end game of this clash of virus and politics is that children, who in themselves have no agency in this toxic debate, are increasingly being caught in the crosshairs of the COVID culture wars. The evidence is visible all across the United States, but especially in the South, where several Republican-controlled states have taken an ideological stance in open defiance of public health guidance and science. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis has gone to war with mask mandates in schools at a time when Florida leads the nation in the number of children hospitalized with COVID. Hospitals in the state are reporting that they are treating patients as young as 2 months old. In Texas, the Republican governor, Greg Abbott, has also banned local authorities from requiring face masks in schools. In the wake of a surge in cases that now puts Texas close behind Florida in the league table of child hospitalizations, he has tried to blame the crisis on the Biden administration and migrants crossing into the United States over from the Mexican border. In Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, another Republican governor, now wants to repeal a law he signed in April banning mask mandates in schools, saying it was an error. But the genie might already be out of the bottle. 1 in 5 new cases in the state are now infecting young people under the age of 18, and hospitals are close to being overrun. Nor does any contention that children are unlikely to get seriously ill from COVID hold water any longer. Peter Hotez, co-director for vaccine development at Texas Children's Hospital, said, "We're seeing a big uptick in COVID-19 pediatric hospitalizations and ICU admissions," adding, "The Delta variant of the coronavirus is now picking off all the young, unvaccinated people who have been lucky enough to escape COVID so far. It's like a forest fire raging across the South." Especially at risk are those children with underlying health conditions such as diabetes, obesity, and, as in the case of Robin McCarthy's 6-year-old son, asthma. When combined with COVID, the result can be pneumonia, as many pediatric hospitals are now experiencing. At worst, children can and do die. CDC data shows that at least 81 children in the United States died of COVID between March and July of this year. The ideological nature of the COVID response in southern states has not only put children in harm's way, it has forced pediatricians to become the last line of defense against an army of angry parents fired up by Republican politicians spouting anti-science rhetoric. At a recent press conference in Louisiana, John Van Schier, a professor of pediatrics and infectious disease at Louisiana State University Health Shreveport, had strong words for his fellow citizens who were turning face masks into a political weapon. He said, "Children in Louisiana have died of COVID and more unfortunately will die." He added, This is not a time for politics or threatening lawsuits about having to wear a face mask. Face masks actually save lives. Professor John Van Scheer told The Guardian that he's treating rising numbers of children with pneumonia brought on by COVID. They are sick enough to need supplemental oxygen, and the more severe ones, especially kids with underlying health conditions, may require a ventilator to breathe for them because their lungs are so sick. Caring for seriously ill children is always distressing, Professor Van Scheer said, but more so when we know that vast majority of these infections are preventable. It carries a frustration, and all of this can be avoided with simple mitigation strategies that we've been using successfully for a year. Louisiana has the unfortunate distinction of being top state in the nation for per capita new cases and deaths from COVID. Yet Republican lawmakers in the state legislature still tried unsuccessfully to pass a law banning face masks and vaccine mandates. Their efforts were foiled when the Democratic governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, reinstated a statewide order requiring all individuals to wear face masks indoors when outside of their homes. Professor Van Scheer had been disturbed by news that some Louisiana parents, influenced by right-wing misinformation, had begun to sue school boards in an attempt to stop the enforcement of masks. The doctor said, "That's just wrong," adding, "Parents are using their children as a political pawn, and that's unacceptable. I'm a physician, and I'm first the parent. There's nothing more precious to me than the life and health of my children. And my challenge to parents is to do the same and put the safety of their children first." Back in Florida, Robin McCarthy is at wit's end about what to do with her six-year-old son. He cannot now go to school for fear that under the cloud of Governor Ron DeSantis' executive order, he could be exposed to the virus, but it is too late to find alternative private schooling where face masks are obligatory. Robin McCarthy has joined the parents of 15 other Florida children with disabilities as plaintiffs in a lawsuit lodged by the Miami-based Disability Independence Group. The lawsuit seeks an injunction on Ron DeSantis' ban on mask mandates in schools. Robin McCarthy said, "You can't sit by and do nothing when innocent children are involved. These politicians are forcing their beliefs on us and are costing innocent lives. This is not politics. My son is not a science experiment. This needs to stop."